Well, it's 11 o'clock. Good morning, everybody. I hope you can hear me way in the back. We were working on the audio as you piled in. I'm going to go ahead and get started. We have a lot to cover today. This session is SPC 219, What's New for IT Professionals in SharePoint Server 2013. I'm Bill Baer. I'm a senior product marketing manager in our SharePoint product group. I focus on the infrastructure aspects of our product on a day-to-day basis. Prior to coming to Microsoft, I was with Hewlett-Packard. I'm also a Microsoft Certified Master and a Microsoft Certified Master Instructor for SharePoint Server. There's a number of different ways you can connect with me. You can visit www.wbaer.net. You can find different ways to connect with me. You can collaborate with me, ask me questions, and participate in discussions. From an objectives perspective, today we're going to talk about some of the core platform investments we've made in SharePoint Server 2013. Understand some of the new features and capabilities that lead to improved security, better reliability, and improved operating economics. And then lastly, we're going to understand the value of SharePoint Server 2013 as it applies to IT professionals. But before we go any further, one of the things that I wanted to say is many of you that are TechNet and MSDN subscribers have probably already started playing with SharePoint Server 2013. You've probably already had access to the bits for several weeks now. For those of you that don't have access to a TechNet or MSDN subscription, that's not going to be a problem anymore. As of 8 o'clock this morning, you can now visit TechNet or MSDN. You can sign up for a new developer site, an Office 365 developer site, or you can begin downloading SharePoint Server 2013 RTM evaluation beginning this morning. So I'm sure all of you are going to run back to your rooms and start downloading that now, and we'll see what we can do to the internet connection here at the Mandalay. So let's go ahead and kick it off. We're going to start with hardware and software requirements and just quickly discuss what's changed from a hardware and software perspective. We're going to move on to upgrade and provisioning. We're going to talk about some of the new service applications and the service application framework on which they reside. And then lastly, we'll talk about some of the improvements we've made around performance and reliability. For those of you that are at the keynote, you got to see a couple of those today throughout the keynote. So let's move into hardware and software requirements. From a hardware perspective, things look a lot like they did in SharePoint Server 2010. A single server, if you're using the integrated or standalone database, you're looking at 8 gigs of RAM, the same 80 gigs from a system drive perspective, and a quad-core processor, 64-bit only. If you're doing development environments or you're performing evaluation, obviously you're going to have more services provisioned. You're going to want to run more service applications. You're going to require more RAM in order to do so, substantially more than just a single server environment. And then lastly, from a web and application server perspective, so servers within a farm topology, you're looking at 12 gigs of RAM, the same 80 gigs system drive space, and the same single quad-core processor requirement. From a prerequisite perspective, it looks a lot like it did again in SharePoint Server 2010. The key changes are we no longer support Windows Server 2008. The minimum requirement is Windows Server 2008 R2 with Service Pack 1, or alternatively, you can use Windows Server 2012. Some of the new prerequisites that you'll find when you run the prerequisite installer is the Windows Management Framework 3.0. Effectively, what that provides is support for Windows PowerShell 3 and all of the benefits that come along with it. So you can think about some of the capabilities, such as persistent PS sessions, one inside of Windows PowerShell 3.0. Also, the ability to schedule jobs directly through PowerShell is another improvement from a 3.0 perspective. .NET Framework 4.5, Windows Server App Fabric, in-memory distributed caching. You saw a lot of the social capabilities that Jeff talked about this morning, and you saw how fluid and dynamic the UI was as it responded to changes in the news feed, and he performed some of those capabilities, such as app mentions and hashtags and filtering and sorting. Much of that is provided by App Fabric caching. For those of you familiar with it, in the past, it was delivered under the code name of Velocity Cache on MSDN. And effectively what it does is it fuses memory across all of the machines and makes them available to the farm in order to make those operations, particularly in the social space, more rapid. And it applies to other caches as well, such as the last modified time cache and the login token cache. We also have support for information protection, so the information protection and control client. And then lastly, WCF data services, so for the creation and consumption of OData services over the web, which is an improvement from a business connectivity services perspective. On the database server side, the same applies as it did on the operating system side. So we no longer support SQL Server 2008. We support SQL Server 2008 R2 with Service Pack 1 as a minimum requirement. And alternatively, you can use SQL Server 2012. From a deployment perspective, a couple of things have changed. We no longer support workgroup installations. You can do a domain controller installation, but it's supported from a development perspective anyway. We don't want you doing that in production environments. From a client OS installation perspective, in SharePoint Server 2010, we allowed you to install SharePoint on client operating systems such as Windows 7. With SharePoint Server 2013, we no longer allow you to install on a client operating system. We actively block those installations. The alternative in that scenario is you can use Hyper-V with Windows 8. Some of the demonstrations you're going to see today, I'm running off of a laptop that's using Windows 8 and Hyper-V, and I'm running my VMs within that. So that's an alternative to the client client operating system support change. Dynamic memory and virtual machines, we didn't support it in 2010. We don't support it in 2013. And then lastly, Windows Web Server. We've dropped support for Windows Web Server. So let's go ahead and get into upgrade and provisioning. We're going to move fast today in order to try to get through all the content. Upgrade and provisioning, what's changed? Let's go ahead and start with system status notifications. As Mikkel was on stage today, one of the things that she pointed out was the only thing that separated the 2013 site from the 2010 site was the ribbon across the top of the page. That ribbon apprises site collection administrators of users of a number of different activities. One, whether or not there's an available upgrade for that particular site collection. Two, if the site collection or its host database is in read-only mode, users will be apprised through the system status notification. And lastly, from a scheduled maintenance perspective, there's also scheduled maintenance notifications. So under circumstances where a user is upgrading a site collection, that's triggered as a maintenance event, and the system status notification will change accordingly. You can also tap into system status notifications, and you can add your own help links and some other information to those. And I'm going to show you an example of adding your own help link. From an upgrade perspective, what enabled all of the backward compatibility that you see today that Mikkel discussed in the demo? What allows you to run code compiled specifically for SharePoint 2010 in SharePoint 2013 without having to recompile that code? What allows you to have that deep backward capability to enable you to have site templates and features related to 2010 that reside inside of a 2013 content database? The key improvement that we've made, or the key change that we've made to upgrade functionality, is we've separated the aspect of schema and site collection upgrade. What that means from an IT pro perspective, when you attach your content databases to SharePoint 2013 for upgrade, the only thing we're going to upgrade by default is the schema. We're going to do index changes, security changes, table valued functions, changes to stored procedures. Anything at the site collection and below won't get upgraded as a result of that upgrade process. So that includes sites, coded site actions, templates, and anything related to a site collection. All of those will continue to run and operate in a backward compatible 2010 mode. What that enables is deferred site collection upgrade. The ability to defer the upgrade to the end user as opposed to performing the upgrade as IT. Many of you may not want to do that. Many of you may want to control the aspect of upgrade on behalf of your users. It doesn't mean we've taken the capability away from you to do that. So you can force an upgrade and force all of the site collections to upgrade when you attach the content databases. Alternatively, you can use Windows PowerShell to iteratively upgrade site collections over time on the end user's behalf. Or lastly, you can actually defer that upgrade to them. The way that we saw it is this enables IT to focus on innovation as opposed to the mundane task of upgrading individual sites. It also establishes a balance between the needs of your users and those of IT. So it's not necessarily forcing an upgrade upon them, but allowing them to choose when upgrade is ready for them. You don't have to install any 2010 binaries in order to enable this capability, because what we've done is we've branched and versioned all of the cascading style sheets and JavaScript from 2010. We've branched and versioned all of the features and templates from SharePoint 2010. And lastly, we've implemented what we call Fusion Redirect Assemblies. Fusion Redirect Assemblies help route the code request, whether the request is 14 or 15 related. One of the things that you're going to see inside of your farm as well is you're going to have a 14 hive inside of your 15 farm. So now you're going to have a side-by-side 14 and 15 hive. Now, developing 2010 customizations for 2013 isn't necessarily the recommendation. So we don't want you to run in a backward compatible mode and continue to write code that targets SharePoint 2010 or that targets 14. We definitely want you to move at some point. But it does enable you to move much more rapidly because it takes one more concern away from an IT perspective. And code was one of the leading issues in terms of upgrade challenges. So site collection health checks, Mikhail ran one of those today. A site collection health check, for those of you that were familiar with Test SP Content Database, for those that you were familiar with the pre-upgrade checker, effectively we've taken that functionality and we've stepped it up a level and we've enabled users to have access to that. That way they can perform their own health checks prior to actually implementing an upgrade. If a user does not perform a health check and chooses to force an upgrade, we'll run the health checks anyway on their behalf prior. If we determine there's an issue that would block upgrade or result in a failure of upgrade, we won't allow that site collection to be upgraded. So the site collection health checks not only provide some self-service capabilities to the users, but they also serve as a stopgap for us to ensure that users won't upgrade site collections in the event that a health check fails. So what we're going to do real quick is we're going to switch gears. We're going to go to a quick demo. Those of you at the keynote saw exactly what that was today. So what we have here is we have a site collection on the screen. It's another Contoso Pharmaceuticals. It's our favorite company here at Microsoft that we like to talk about. As you can see, we have the ribbon up at the top that enables us to allow the site collection administrator to know that an upgrade is available for them. So what we're going to go ahead and do is we're going to do what Mikhail did this morning. We're going to go to site settings. From site settings, we're going to scroll down, and we're going to find our way to the site collection health checks. We'll run a health check, and it should find a number of issues that we should address, such as the video content type. Obviously, we have new digital media content types inside of SharePoint 2013 that will conflict with the SharePoint 2010 video content type. This is a warning. So as you can see, there's checks that ran successfully, and there's checks that generate a warning. So you can think about it like a stoplight to some extent. You're going to have greens, which is all good. You're going to have oranges, which indicate that there's a problem, but it's not necessarily going to prevent an upgrade, which means it can be addressed prior to or following the upgrade. And lastly, you may see a red bar. Anything that appears in that red bar would block a successful upgrade and won't allow the upgrade to process. So I'm going to go ahead and go back to site settings real quick. We'll scroll down, and we're just going to go through site collection upgrade. So we'll click upgrade this site collection. We'll do the same thing we did this morning and click I'm ready. And what you're going to see is the upgrade is going to run. It's going to generate a number of warnings, largely related to my customization because I've branded my site. So I've made some changes to the master page. I've separated them from their definition. They need to be reset. And the other problem, obviously, is our content type that we need to address once the upgrade is complete. And again, what enabled this capability is the fact that we've separated site collection and schema upgrade. So while this upgrade runs and completes itself, we can go back to the home page, and it's as simple as that. So basically what we've done as a site collection administrator is we've run an upgrade on the user's behalf. If you paid attention to the top of the screen, you saw that that system status bar notification changed. It said, we're performing maintenance on the site right now. Please bear with us. There may be some glitches. At the end of that statement, you saw a more information link. You can use Windows PowerShell to create your own more information link. So as users are upgrading their site collections or site collections are being upgraded on their behalf, you can inject your own statement into those system status notifications to link to your own content. So from an adoption perspective, perhaps you have specific collateral or IP that you'd like to share with users about how to use SharePoint 2013. Perhaps you have some known issues surrounding upgrade that you would like to direct them to. As the site collection upgrades, they can click on that link, and it'll take them to that IP or that collateral as long as it's a URL that's accessible. So that's one of the new things that we've done from an upgrade perspective. So coming back to the slides real quick as we move on, we've also enabled evaluation site collections. What if a user is not ready to upgrade to SharePoint Server 2013 right away? What if they have concerns about upgrading their production content? They don't necessarily want to commit to an upgrade because they know there's not necessarily a rollback short of restoring the database, which obviously, as we all know, impacts all of the users within that particular database. So what we decided to do is create evaluation site collections. What's an evaluation site collection? A user now, through the upgrade process, they don't have to click that I'm ready button. They can click the let's hold off button, or they can click the try it out. And basically what try it out does is it creates an evaluation of the site. That evaluation site collection is a copy of their production site collection, and it uses one of two technologies in order to facilitate that operation. If you're running an edition of Microsoft SQL Server that supports snapshotting, we take a snapshot of the production site collection, we copy it, we upgrade that snapshot, and then we append the URL with dash eval. So if their site was http foo slash sites slash site 1, their eval site will be foo slash sites slash site 1 dash eval. At the very top of the page in their evaluation site collection, they're going to see something as well, system status notification. That system status notification is going to apprise them of a couple of things. One, that it is an evaluation site collection. It is not their production site collection, and they shouldn't make any changes to it in terms of uploading content. This is purely for them to validate that the upgrade won't significantly impair their site once they actually perform the upgrade. The other thing it's going to do is it's going to have a countdown. Evaluation site collections aren't perpetual. They can be if you want them to be, but they don't have to be. By default, they live for 30 days. We have timer jobs that run that not only create the upgrade evaluation site collection, but will also delete the upgrade evaluation site collection. If a user commits the production content to upgrade, the evaluation site collection that it's based on will go away as well. And then one last thing about evaluation site collections is the other method that they're created is if you're running an edition of Microsoft SQL Server that does not support snapshot technology, we divert or we fall back to backup and restore. So we use our native backup and restore APIs in order to backup the site collection, restore it, and then upgrade. The challenge with that, obviously, is during that operation, the production site collection will be in read-only mode as we take the backup and restore it in order to perform the upgrade as an evaluation site collection. That does not apply in snapshots. So let me go ahead and flip back to the demo real quick, and we'll take a look at what it looks like from a user's perspective. So here we have another site. It's in a backward-compatible 2010 mode. We're going to go ahead and go back down to site settings. We're going to scroll to site collection upgrade. And there's a button that says, try a demo upgrade. They click on the button that says, create an evaluation site collection. And they're going to get a notification that says, we've received your request. It may take 1 or 2 days in order for us to process it. The reason it says it may take 1 or 2 days is because the creation of the evaluation site collection is based on a timer job. That timer job scheduled interval by default is related to this message. So that's why it says it may take a day or two. You'll also receive an email as a site collection administrator as soon as the evaluation site collection becomes available, as well as its URL. So from a user's perspective, they choose to create the evaluation site collection. It gets created. It gets upgraded. They get an email to let them know that that evaluation site collection is ready for them. From a timer job perspective, it's all based on timer job definitions. There's a create upgrade evaluation site collections timer job definition. You can run that on demand. You can change the schedule, or you can just keep the default schedule, which aligns well to the message or the notification that end users receive when they opt to create an upgrade evaluation site collection. So if we scroll through, we will see here that we have create upgrade evaluation site collections timer job. And that's the daily timer job. And again, that's why the notification indicates that it may take a day or two in order for their site collection to become available. Alternatively, you can always run that on demand, or you can change the schedule to run more frequently. One of the other things that I should mention as well is a lot of people ask, well, what if I have 10,000 users, 50,000 users upgrading all at the same time? We thought about that when we built this upgrade process and we throttle the upgrades. All of you probably remember when we introduced throttling to SharePoint. We introduce throttling now to upgrade, so we can proactively throttle upgrades. We only allow a certain number of upgrades to be performed at any given point in time by default. We allow up to 10 upgrades concurrently per content database, or 5 per web application instance. The way that that works is you have 2 front ends. Your web application obviously is going to span both front ends. That enables you to have 10 concurrent upgrades, because that's what the content database is limited to as well. So now you can run 10 concurrent upgrades. The rest of the upgrades will sit in a queue, and as resources become available, they'll be processed. You can also change that schedule, or you can change those throttles and enable more upgrades to occur concurrently. Although one of the things that you should validate in a pilot environment or an evaluation environment is the impact of enabling more concurrent upgrades to run in succession inside of your environment. So we're going to run back to the slides, and we'll come back to that evaluation site collection because we're going to do a couple of things with it. Site provisioning modes. I talked about how we have deep backward compatibility. We separated the aspects of site collection and schema upgrade. That enables us to have deep backward compatibility. Everything runs in a backward compatible SharePoint 2010 mode. The important thing to understand is when you are in a backward compatible 2010 mode, you only have access to SharePoint 2010 features and capabilities. You don't have access to any of the 2013 features and capabilities when you're in a backward compatible mode. As Mikhail said this morning, this really is a 2010 site. You won't have a news feed at the site collection level. You won't be able to participate in the social capabilities that we've built inside of 2013. You won't benefit from the performance improvements, such as smooth transitions, when you're in a backward compatible mode. All of those capabilities are obviously 2013 capabilities. In order to get there, you need to upgrade your site collection to SharePoint Server 2013. What you can see here is page rendering coexistence. This is what enables you to have code that runs in a backward compatible mode. So code compiled for 14 will continue to run inside of 15 due to our 14 assembly redirect policy, or Fusion redirect assemblies. You can also see that we have our 14 hive up over on the left and our 15 hive on the right. And that's what enables us to run in a backward compatible mode. But backward compatibility isn't only limited to upgrade. Backward compatibility also extends to site provisioning. You can provision backward compatible sites in Windows PowerShell, or you can alternatively provision a Windows or a backwards compatible site inside of central administration. So if you have a need to continue to run in a backward compatible mode for any specific length of time, perhaps you're concerned about user adoption because the UI changes. Perhaps you're concerned about, from a code perspective, you're not ready to upgrade your code. Your developers don't have time. But you would like to move the infrastructure. You would like to be ahead of the game. You can force users to create sites in two modes, effectively. In 14 mode, which means they can only create 2010 sites inside of the 2013 environment. You can enable the creation of only 2013 sites in the 2013 environment. Or lastly, you can create sites in what we call a mixed mode, which is basically allowing the user to choose which version of a site collection they want to create. So in this example, I can create one called Hello. And we can scroll down and give it a URL. And one of the things that you're going to see is an experience option. You're going to get a drop down for the experience. In this particular mode that I'm running this environment in, I'm allowing people to do both. I'm allowing them to create 2013 sites as well as 2010 sites. You'll notice when I filter to 2010, and let me just scroll down so you can see this. When I filter to 2010, if you keep an eye on the collaboration tab, you're going to see it changes. And the reason it changes is because we're not going to allow you to provision a 2010 site using a 2013 template. You're limited to just what's available to SharePoint 2010. And that's the key takeaway. So you can't run in a backward compatible mode and leverage all of the features and capabilities of 2013. In order to do that, you need to get users to upgrade their site collections. So I'm going to go ahead and come back to the slides real quick as we work our way through this. Self-service site creation, what's changed? Most IT professionals I know never enable self-service site creation. The last thing that they want is users to be able to create site collections on their own without any guidance or without any compliance tied to that. The last thing they want is users mucking up their information management policies and governance policies. The last thing that they want is chaos and sprawl because it is a site collection that they're creating. Many people just wanted the ability to create a site. I'd love it if my users could proactively create sites. That would be great. I have control over that. I can establish base permissions at the site collection level. I can create my content types. I can ensure they're being effectively utilized by the users. In self-service site creation inside of SharePoint 2013, you can do that now. You can enable people to create site collections. You can enable them to create a site under an existing site, or you can enable them to create entirely new sites, or project sites as we like to call them. One of the other things that you can do is you can specify a custom form on which site creation should be based. So users don't have to work through the self-service site creation form that we provide out of the box. You can use your own custom form now and direct self-service site creation requests to your custom form. That custom form can live on the same web application where the site should be created or an entirely different web application. And that web application could even be on a different farm environment. The other thing that we decided to do is one of the things that we saw is IT doesn't enable self-service site creation because they can't establish or tie a policy to any newly created site collections. So what we decided to do is we've implemented the ability to require users to select from a list of policies when a site collection is created. Those policies are based on information management policies. So if you remember from earlier versions of SharePoint, we introduced what we call information management policies. Those policies are auditing, retention, barcodes, labels. What you can do inside of SharePoint 2013 now is at your content type hub, so obviously the prerequisite becomes managed metadata, you can create information management policies. So for example, you could create a retention policy that specifies delete 1 year after create date. You can give that policy a name, and then from the selection and self-service site creation where it says project classification settings, you can make that a required choice. When a user creates a site, they are required to choose from a set of predefined policies. Those policies get pushed down from that content type hub to enable them to be applied to site collections across your environment. So if auditing and retention is your thing, and you need to have that kind of compliance, whether it's Sarbanes-Oxley or your own internal governance policies that you want to implement, you can do that through self-service site creation now. You can enable that or enforce users to classify their sites as they're created. There's a couple of related sessions and labs in this particular section of today's session. PowerShell administration with SharePoint 2013 is SPC 195. 211 is an upgrade overview. 210 is an upgrade deep dive. I highly recommend this session for those of you that are interested in the internals of upgrade, the challenges that you may face, and how to work yourself around them in the event that they occur. We also have two hands-on labs to complement these three sessions, Deferred Site Collection Upgrade and SharePoint Server 2013. So if you want to walk through the aspects of creating an evaluation site collection via Windows PowerShell or through the user interface, you want to create an evaluation site collection through the UI from an end user's perspective, or if you would like to learn more about what's new in PowerShell 3, or PowerShell may just be new to you as an IT professional, I highly recommend these two hands-on labs and these three sessions. Now we're going to switch gears. We're going to talk about service applications. The first thing to understand from a service application framework is it's the same service application framework from SharePoint 2010. It's the first time that we haven't changed the service application framework on you. In SharePoint Server 2003, you had your profile database. In SharePoint Server 2007, we shifted to a shared service provider model. In SharePoint Server 2010, we shifted to a service application model, which provided the ability to consume service applications a la carte, but also delegate permissions to those particular service applications to enable other people to administer the aspects of those service applications, such as search. This is the first release where we felt like we found the right balance in terms of the flexibility to provision a la carte, the flexibility to develop your own service applications as an ISV, and lastly, the ability to delegate. So we retain that same service application framework, which is good news because it helps facilitate a smoother upgrade process because you're moving from apples to apples, this time from a release perspective. What's new is the user profile service. We didn't do a whole lot here because it worked well. Yeah, I hear a bunch of... Obviously, some of you may have had challenges with it. So let's talk about what we did. The first thing that we heard from all of you in the room is, I want my old profile import back. I do not want to use Forefront Identity Manager. I want Active Directory import back. All I care about is unidirectional synchronization. I'm not doing bidirectional. I'm not writing back to the source. I just want to consume profiles from Active Directory or from some other source. So we call it the three-legged stool. We give you three things. One, you can actually provision user profile service without having a PhD. You can do it through the UI now. You don't have to change permissions. That's one of the big things. So for one, we don't have this complex set of guidance to where you have to elevate the permissions of a service account, provision the service application, de-elevate, go to Active Directory, and ask your identity guy to elevate the permissions or change some of the access that a service account may have. It just works out of the box now. It's click, 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 you have a user profile service application. That's providing you use the FIM method. If you look down here in the list, you also see use SharePoint Active Directory import. What is that? Think SharePoint Server 2007 and earlier. how you imported identity. You pointed it at a source and it consumed. It's back. We brought it back in 2013. So the FIM approach stays, the 2007 and earlier approach comes back, and lastly, what if you don't care about an identity manager or you have your own identity manager? That's the ability to implement an external identity manager from a user profile perspective. The next thing in user profiles is the user profile replication engine. So you have multiple farms. You need to be able to take data or information about your users and replicate it across either separate geographics or maybe just two data centers. The only way really to do that was the user profile replication engine. We shipped it as part of the SharePoint administration toolkit, which we update frequently. And again, I'm being facetious. I think we updated it once. One of the challenges with that is shipping it as a toolkit component is it didn't get the engineering attention that it deserved. So people took a dependency on it, and we heard you when you said you took a dependency on it. We heard you when you said your production implementation or your disaster recovery scenario is dependent on the user profile replication engine. Unfortunately, again, it was a piece of code shipped with an administration toolkit. Different release cycle than SharePoint, different methodology in terms of how we can update it and how we can make improvements to it. So what we've done is we've taken away the user profile replication engine. We took it away and we built it into the product. We don't ship it as an administration toolkit component anymore. The user profile replication engine becomes part of the user profile service. It's native. What that means is from a cumulative update and a service pack perspective, we can fix issues real time as we find them, as opposed to trying to patch a separate set of binaries. My sites and social data. In SharePoint 2010, you had your social database. And that was the bottleneck in terms of I/O. You only had one methodology to scale your social database, and that was to scale vertically, because you could only have one of them, or one instance of it. So you couldn't scale horizontally. What we decided to do inside of SharePoint Server 2013 is we've made a number of investments around the social capabilities that you saw Jeff demonstrate today. In order to make that happen, we did two things. The velocity cache, app fabric caching, distributed in-memory caching. We talked about that in the very beginning in the prerequisites. The second thing that we did is all of the social data related to an individual is stored in the same content database as their My Site. What that enables you to do is scale horizontally from a social perspective and optimize the use of your storage infrastructure. And it also reduces any I/O constraints versus that single social database. So from an I/O perspective, you're going to find and see smoother I/O operations as related to the social capabilities. We have a new app management service that provides marketplace and corporate catalog services. Many of you are probably already familiar with the marketplace that we have with SharePoint today, made possible by our new app model. You can have a marketplace in one of two ways. You can have a marketplace provisioned strictly for use by your customers or by your users. That's a corporate catalog, an internal app directory through which your users can consume applications that you develop in-house and you provide to your users in-house. Or you can enable them access to the marketplace where they can consume applications from our public Microsoft Marketplace. So the Microsoft Marketplace comes in two ways, a corporate catalog and a marketplace. The marketplace is public and Microsoft managed. We curate all of the code that arrives there. Then you have your corporate catalog that you can provision on-premises. That one is private and IT managed. Or optionally, you can use both. So if you have something like an asset library that's been developed internally that you want to make available to users, but you also want to make available some simple calendar functionality, you can do both with our new app management service. So you can consume applications from two different catalogs depending on the needs of your users. From a BCS perspective, we've enabled OData support. So one of the things that enables our new app model, very briefly, is new support for OAuth. So from an authorization perspective, we've added OAuth to the product. OAuth can help in a number of things. And the way that I like to look at OAuth is think of it as a valet key. You can provide it to somebody and it enables them to park your car. It doesn't enable them to open your glove box. So it's something that you have that you can allow somebody to utilize, albeit in a limited fashion. We also have a new translation service. We heard you there. So again, like the user profile service, there were no problems with variations, but we decided to give you an improvement anyway. a new translation service that now enables you to programmatically translate not only sites. So in the past, you can perform translations, but those translations were limited to the Chrome. So you could translate the quick launch, you could translate the breadcrumbs, some of the site actions. But what about the content? The content's the most important thing to translate. Our new translation service is based on a cloud-based machine translation implementation. What it enables you to do is not only translate sites, but also the content within those sites. You can translate that content in a number of different ways. That content can be translated synchronously and asynchronously, and you can also use streaming data access. Our translation service is also extensible. So we provide representational state, and we provide client-side object model support in order to facilitate developing against our machine translation service. So real quick, one of the reasons that we did this is obviously you collaborate on a global perspective. You have users everywhere. In many cases, you want to be able to share a document with an individual, but you don't want to incur the expense, time, or effort of having somebody localize every piece of content so you can collaborate with your partners in other countries. Sometimes it may be a specification. So it may be something simple that changes over time, and you can't afford to continuously localize that content. So what we've done is given you a machine translation service to enable you to quickly translate content on the fly. So what we'll do is we're going to click on this proposal for Humongous Insurance, and it's going to load in the Word web app. Once this loads in the Word web app, we can do a number of different things with it. So as we can see, we have the document here. We'll let it load. You can see that the document's in English. There's the footer, the table of contents, and let's just scroll down and allow a page to load before we actually perform translation against it. So this proposal, perhaps this proposal is fairly dynamic. It changes over time. It changes on a weekly basis. I'm making iterative updates to that document, but I want to be able to share it with my counterparts and my peers in order to have them collaborate with me. So what I can do is very easily as a user, click on the translate button, and I can say, I want to go ahead and translate this into Indonesian. Click OK. What it's going to do is it's going to send that document to a machine-based or a cloud-based machine translation service where the actual translation is performed. It's going to come back to me, and the document is now in Indonesian. So as you can see here, we're working with the same document. I can scroll through. The table of contents has been translated. And if I continue to work my way down and allow it to load, the content's been translated as well. At the top of the page, system status notification. One more time. They're pervasive throughout the product. That enables a user to know that they're working with a translated document. So we're going to take away some functionality. Because we performed a real-time translation of a document, we don't want them editing it in that language. So they will see that at the top of the screen, and they can always revert back to the original. It's fully extensible. You can build into it. You can build apps that consume its functionality. Again, it is machine translation. That means it's not perfect. From a perfection perspective, you're going to lose context. Machine translation is all about taking one word in one natural language and converting it to its corresponding word in another natural language. So to some extent, you lose a little bit of context. If we come back to this example, I love SharePoint might make sense in English, but from a contextual perspective, if I just write it out that way in any other language, it may not make sense. But the person receiving it understands the message that I was trying to relay to them. And that's the point of machine translation services in SharePoint 2013. We also have a work management service. Jeff talked about our work management service a little bit this morning. Basically, what it enables is task aggregation. The way that we like to think about it is a task is a task is a task no matter where you create it. If you create it in Outlook, it's going to get replicated to SharePoint. It's going to be available in SharePoint. If you edit it in SharePoint, it's going to get replicated back to Exchange or Project or any other work management server that you may choose to tie in to our work management platform. So at the end of the day, a task is a task is a task. No matter where you create that task is pervasive, and it's going to show up in our other service applications. So it's task aggregation at the end of the day that works across our work management systems. We also introduced a new PowerPoint automation service In our past release, we had Word Automation Services, which allowed you to perform file conversions against Word documents. Perhaps you wanted to take a Word document and convert it to HTML or some read-only format, such as PDF. You can do that with PowerPoint now. It's based on the same Word Automation Services or WAS architecture. So if you're familiar developing against Word Automation Services, you'll be familiar developing against PowerPoint Automation Services. It's about taking a PowerPoint presentation and perhaps converting it into a read-only PDF, or perhaps converting it into an image file. Maybe the person receiving the file doesn't have access to PowerPoint. Maybe you want it to be read-only, or maybe you want to present it just as a series of images. You can do that through automation now. Here's one of my favorite things. You're going to learn a little more about this week. For those of you that don't know already, the Office web applications are no longer a service application that you provision as part of SharePoint. It's no longer an installation on top of SharePoint. Office web applications are now their own server product, which means you install Office web applications on their own dedicated server farm environment. That environment provides web apps experience to multiple SharePoint farms. That was one of the key reasons for doing it. You can have one Office web apps farm that provides its services to multiple SharePoint farms, but above and beyond that, Office web apps is now accessible through Exchange, Link, a URL accessible file server, or even a third-party document store. So if you're using Documentum or UMC for your document storage, you can still use the web apps in order to present a web-based view of that particular document, such as what we did with the document that we translated. So they become their own server product. It'll simplify patching. Because if those of you that were using Office web apps, obviously you had cumulative updates related to Foundation, cumulative updates related to SharePoint Server, cumulative updates related to Office web apps. Now you can patch your Office web apps farm separately, and you can scale it independently of SharePoint and provide its services to a number of applications that you've deployed in your enterprise. One of my other favorite things is in SharePoint Server 2013, all of us were embarrassed to send a WAC URL to any of our friends and family. You couldn't paste it inside of an IM window because your scroll bar that used to be about an inch big all of a sudden becomes about a millimeter thin because the link's so long. You couldn't put it in an email because you were just too embarrassed to send that to anybody. So what you did was you masked it behind something. I always saw the click here to view the document, and then they would click here, and obviously it would take them to this link. For some of us, and probably all of us, and I'm sure there's a few of you where you don't mind this experience, some of you might even have been able to remember those URLs. So maybe you just looked at it and said, okay, yeah, I know where that document is. So we decided that that was a little too complex, and what we've done is we've changed the composure of a URL as related to the web apps. You look here towards the bottom of the screen, this is a WAC URL now in SharePoint Server 2013. The only thing that separates the document from opening in the web app as opposed to opening in the client is the web equals one parameter. So the easy way to think about it is if I ever want to send a document to somebody, all I have to do is add the web equals one parameter to force it to open in Office web apps. I take the parameter off, and I force it to open in the client. We feel like you should be able to remember a URL now and send that URL to anybody without any embarrassment. That is one of my favorite things about Office web apps. And all of the work that we've done to improve Office web apps, to enable co-authoring, to enable translation or native translation built right in there in the web apps, my favorite thing is the fact that I can actually remember a URL now, and I can send a URL to somebody. Web analytics, much like user profile service, much like variations, we felt like it worked pretty well, so we cut it. Web analytics is gone as a service application inside of SharePoint Server 2013. If you go to the upgrade overview session or you go to the upgrade deep dive session, you're going to learn about what that means from an upgrade perspective. So if you are using the web analytics service application, there's special upgrade considerations. Basically, that analytics data won't be transferred to your 2013 environment. There will be some click-through data that is retained at the site collection level, but otherwise, you're not going to be able to carry that with you. What we decided to do was reinvent web analytics inside of SharePoint. We have a new web analytics platform that's based on search. SharePoint Server 2013 represents the grand unification of FAST and SharePoint Search. When we acquired FAST many years ago, the biggest question that we always received at Microsoft is, when is FAST going to become the search engine for SharePoint? The answer is now. SharePoint 2013, we've unified FAST and SharePoint Search to make that the experience for our users. As a result, as we thought about web analytics, who knows better about how users work with information than Search? Search knows what people look for. It not only knows what they look for, it knows where they go after they've found it. So when I search for Contoso sales data, Search knows where I go after Contoso sales data. What document did I hit? But not only what document did I visit, what document did you visit? Or what document did one of my peers visit? So it's based on a number of things about how we work with data now. So analytics becomes much more intelligent. It's all about hot indicators. So what's popular based on number of views is a good measurement of what's popular, because a lot of people have looked at it. Is it because people are looking at it because it's the first search result, or are people looking at it because it's the best search result? And that's why we decided to build analytics on top of search. That enables us to not only base it on number of views, but also the number of unique users to a particular view. So we can start to correlate data and build a better analytics experience. We also understand how content's being used, which we did in 2010, but comparatively, how that relates to other content with the environment. And that brings me back to that first statement, where a lot of people may have clicked it predominantly because it's the first search result, as opposed to being the best search result. Analytics now inside of SharePoint Server 2013 can help us understand how people work with information, but also the information that's important to them. So it's great from an analytics perspective to understand how your users work with information. If you think about Yammer today, when Adam and Dave were talking and Jeff was talking, one of the things that they mentioned that enabled them to have such a compelling platform is their analytics information. They can proactively respond to the way that users are working with features, working with information, and build capabilities on the fly that tailor to that, or revisit features in order to improve them to facilitate better collaboration. Think of web analytics inside of SharePoint the same way. From an IT perspective, you can look at the hot indicators, you can look at the usage numbers, you can look at how people work with information and work across the feature set to understand where there's an opportunity to improve, or perhaps there's a gap to address, or you can use it in its purest sense, which is just purely from an analytics perspective. And lastly, it remains open for third-party development. So before we move on to the next section, there's a couple of related sessions to this particular section of the presentation. What's new with service applications in SharePoint Server 2013, SPC 263? My assumption is that you will have access to the slides, so hopefully you're not trying to write this down real quick. Getting started with social adoption and cross-farm services is another great session. We have a session on web apps. That session is important because we're having one of our PMs from our web apps team fly in to tell you exactly what they were thinking and what they did and how you should address the shift in our web app strategy. Deploying social in the enterprise, configuring and managing access services. From an IT professional's perspective, if you don't know what's happened with access services, and I'm not going to let the cat out of the bag, I'm going to let you go to that session and figure it out, and then you're going to be glad I sent you. User profile synchronization best practices. We have a user profile synchronization services section. It's going to talk about some of the improvements and how simple it is now to use user profile service. Hands-on labs. We have a hands-on lab that shows you how to do machine translation. You've probably seen code samples on MSDN. So we have C#. So we have server-side customizations using the server-side object model, and then we have client-side object model. We have JavaScript references that you can perform. What we decided to do was take all of those pieces of code and translate them into PowerShell for you so you could perform asynchronous translation using Windows PowerShell based on C# code that's on MSDN. I'd recommend that lab. It's definitely helpful from an IT perspective. The next lab, information management. This lab walks you through how to create an information management policy and tie it to the aspect of self-service site creation. And then we also have how do you configure Office web applications now and associate web apps with a SharePoint farm or with an Exchange environment. Performance and availability. Minimal download strategy. What is minimal download strategy? Minimal download strategy is all about ensuring that a client, when they visit a page and navigate to a new page, the only thing that changes is the delta between those two pages or the differential between those two pages. It results in a much more fluid experience. It makes SharePoint feel like a rich application. From a transition perspective, everything becomes much smoother. It's all based on a new framework that we've put together. That framework is based on a relationship between the client and the server. So what we've done is we've implemented a new download manager that interfaces between controls on the page and the server. It's responsible for sending the delta block back to the client when the client navigates between two pages. So when you look at a SharePoint page, you have two unique elements. You have what we call the Chrome. The Chrome defines the master page and the overall style and the layout of the content on that page. The easiest way to think about the Chrome runs across the top of the page and down the side, the quick launch menu and your ribbon across the top of the page. The remainder of the page is composed of what we call the content area, where the actual content resides. The Chrome will always remain static as users navigate now due to minimal download strategy, and only the content area gets updated. You can enable it and disable it. So from a customization perspective, if you haven't built your customizations in line with our new minimal download strategy, what's going to happen is we're going to fall back to what we call a classic fully rendered page. A classic fully rendered page is the page reloads every time you navigate. Home to shared docs to some list to another list, those are page reloads. Mikhail talked about how we've implemented 40% more efficient use or more effective use of your bandwidth. We do that by not reloading an entire page on every request. So what we can do real quick is we can change gears from minimal download and just take a quick look at some of what minimal download looks like inside of the browser. So I'm going to go ahead and come to this site. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go from the home page to the sales data list. Watch the Chrome. And again, the Chrome is represented by the top of the page running across where the ribbon is, as well as the branding. And it also runs down the left side of the page where the traditional quick launch menu is. The remainder of the page is composed of the content area. So if you keep your eye on the Chrome and you keep your eye on the content area, as I transition across, you're going to notice how smooth that transition is as I work my way into the sales data list. There was no Chrome refresh and there was no flicker. The other thing that minimal download does is every time you sorted or filtered something inside of SharePoint Server 2010, what happened? The page flickered. The entire page reloaded every time. If you branded that page to any extreme, so in SharePoint Server 2010, your average page size was 1.1 meg anyway when a user visited. So if you branded that and added some customization to that, perhaps you added some imagery, or you have a very deep cascading style sheet, so you've done some branding work, that just means more for the client to pull. So the pages are bigger and bigger. So every time you have to reload, when you sort or filter a list, you have to download data. Now when I sort, I can say Europe. Keep an eye on the list, on the country column. I click Europe, and it filters in the browser. So the entire experience now inside of SharePoint 2013 is based inside of the browser. So from a sorting and filtering perspective, if I want to go ahead and descend, again, that transition is within the browser. There is no page flicker. So I can constantly move back and forth, and as you can see, the Chrome's not changing. Only what resides within the content area is changing. Since nothing else changes on the page, we're not going to make an effort to reload anything else. And again, the way to make this work is if you do have customizations, make sure that they honor our minimal download strategy framework. We're down to about 8 minutes, so I'm going to speed things up. Request management. We've introduced new application-centric request prioritization and routing capabilities inside of SharePoint Server 2013. A lot of you are immediately thinking, okay, well, this sounds like what my load balancer does. It's not a load balancer. It's all about request prioritization and routing. What does that mean? What if you have a search request and you want to send it somewhere else, perhaps to a search farm? You can use request management to send that request to your search environment. What if you're concerned about denial of service attacks? You have a WCM implementation or a .com based on SharePoint Server 2013. How do you address that? You can block unknown or bad requests, or known bad requests can be blocked from ever arriving inside of your environment. You can take the details about any request that arises or arrives inside of your SharePoint environment, and you can send that request somewhere else. You can block that request. You can throttle that request. Or that request can be transitioned across machines based on the new health weighting scheme. So when you install SharePoint Server 2013, we establish a health weight. All of your machines have a health weight associated with them. Requests are routed based on health weight. So a user arrives in the environment, we look for the healthiest machine, and we ensure that that request is processed on that machine. The other thing that you can do with it is from a prioritization perspective, A lot of people want to run background services. They want to run profile import during the day. They want to perform search crawls during the day. Unfortunately, the end result is you're doing that at the expense of your users. You're taking away resources from them in order to facilitate another action or operation. So if you do have background services, you can prioritize how requests are handled, which means I want to give favor to my user's request as opposed to this background service. So I always want to ensure an optimal user experience. So I'm not doing things at the expense of my users. I'm actually bringing them closer to my farm. We have our cache service. The cache service is based on the velocity cache. It provides in-memory distributed caching. Again, we fuse memory across machines. We bring it together, and it enables our social capabilities. It enables capabilities around caching of tokens. So from an affinity perspective, your load balancer used to have need to have affinity. From a federated auth perspective, because the fed auth cookie needed it, now you can use the token cache, and you don't necessarily need that same layer of affinity. You can only use the version of App Fabric that we ship with SharePoint. You can't use your own version of App Fabric. You can't download it from Windows Server and install it. You have to use the version that we ship. The other thing I'm going to show you is shredded storage. Mikhail talked about the differential today. Everybody knows what happened inside of SharePoint Server 2010. You had a 10 meg PowerPoint presentation. A user downloaded it and created a version by adding 1 meg of content. They saved it. What would happen is we would send the differential from the client to the server. That was implemented by our COBOL protocol, or file synchronization via SOAP over HTTP. So only the delta was sent between the client and the front end. The front end subsequently requested a copy of the full file from the database server and merged the change the user made inside of the web server and then wrote it back to SQL as a new full file. So now you have the 10 meg V1 and the 11 meg V2, and so on. So a version was really a copy of the file inclusive of its change. The penalty that you paid every time you updated a file was effectively like 2 reads and 2 writes. So now we make more efficient use of I/O. We smooth out the I/O operations by sending the delta to the database server because a version becomes a version becomes a version. So I'm going to try one more demo. In interest of time, I'm going to make it super fast. I'm going to come back over here to my front end, and I am just going to close a couple of things. I put together a little utility that monitors a stored procedure. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to open up this slide. Oh. Awesome. You guys caught it. So I'm going to go ahead and open a presentation. Let me authenticate real quick. And then I promise after this, we've got about 4 more slides. We should be able to make it. So I'm going to have a presentation open. I'm going to go ahead and scroll to the very bottom of this presentation, and I'm going to add a new slide. What we have here is a 7.78 megabyte PowerPoint presentation that I've added a new slide to. That slide's probably somewhere around 248-ish K. So I'm going to go ahead and establish a baseline on my SQL server so I can show you what the end results are. So I'm going to put in my database server's name. And what it's going to do real quick for me is it's just going to prepare a baseline. What I'm looking at is I'm looking at the log file. I have no other load against this environment. I have no other users actively collaborating. So I know my log should effectively be fairly static. So once I have a baseline available to me, what I can do is save the file. And I'm going to save it back to SharePoint. I have versioning enabled on the document library. Let's go ahead and look at the size of the file that got written to SQL Server. 208 kilobytes was written to SQL Server. In SharePoint 2010, that would have been 7.78 megabytes plus 208 kilobytes written to the database server in order to facilitate that change. Do the math and figure out that ratio, and then see how much we're saving you in terms of storage and I/O utilization, because now we just send that delta back. Because what we do is we take a single blob, like you're accustomed to in SharePoint Server 2010, where a file is effectively one big piece of unstructured data in the database. One monolithic stream. We break that out into multiple blobs now. Each blob has a unique ID assigned to it so we can recompile it. When we do need to make an update to a file, we only update the portion corresponding to that change. So a 5 meg file, for example, becomes 5 1-meg blobs. And then the only thing that we update is that 1 meg blob that corresponds to the change that the user made. In this case, the only thing that was updated was that portion of the file that corresponded to the change that I made, or the end of that particular file. So I'm going to go ahead and close this real quick. One of the other things that I'm going to say, if you are interested in any of more background about these capabilities, I'm going to start blogging in depth about them as soon as I walk out the door. I've already got them lined up. I'm just going to hit publish. I'm going to also share the code for this little shredded storage piece that I did with you here today. So the thing that you saw that measured the size of the change, I'm going to share that with you so you can figure out exactly from a storage perspective what you can anticipate seeing in terms of savings. So moving very fast, we've done the shredded storage demo. We've made a number of improvements on the database side. We've aligned ourselves to SQL Azure compliance criteria. We've removed unused indices that we use to track links. We've reduced I/O when you browse your document libraries. You can think about a lot of the minimal download strategy stuff that we've did, and we also use sparse columns for those greater than 1024. So we enable a lot of SQL capabilities. A couple of related sessions and hands-on labs. Last one I'm going to show you, licensing. How many people deploy standard Cal of SharePoint server? Quite a few. Enterprise Cal? How many people that have deployed Enterprise Cal wish that you can only give your users or a subset of your users standard Cal features? Probably a lot of you. You want to use Enterprise Cal, but you only want Enterprise Cal for a subset of your users, or you only want to enable the capabilities for a subset of your users. We have now what we call license enforcement and assignment, or user license enforcement in SharePoint Server 2010. There's a hands-on lab on it as well. What it does is it enables you to tie licensing attributes to Active Directory security groups. I can create a security group called my Enterprise Cal users and one called my Standard Cal users, perhaps one called my Office Web Apps Edit users, my project server users, and I can map licensing or the ability to use specific features to that Active Directory security group. So instead of talking about it, we're going to take a quick look at it. We're going to go back, and you don't have to remind me this time. We're going to go to user licensing. As you can see here, I have an Excel Web Access web part on my homepage. That is obviously an Enterprise Cal feature. I'm Bill. I have access to that feature. I have a separate Active Directory security group for standard Cal users, in which I put Ryan Danner. Ryan does not have access to standard Cal features. He only has access, or to enterprise features, he has access to only standard Cal features. I'm going to log in as Ryan, and look what happened with the web part. He now gets a message that lets him know that he doesn't have access to this particular feature. Please contact your licensing administrator, which is basically the farm administrator. So you can limit access to Enterprise Cal features without ruining the end user experience, without a bunch of authentication prompts or writing a bunch of code to strip them out of your site collections. So, as you can see, it says we can't find your license to use this particular feature. There is a hands-on lab. There is no session. I'm going to skip the summary. I'm going to show you one last thing. From a PowerShell perspective, last SPC, I put together a Silverlight-based Windows PowerShell command builder that enabled you to visually construct PowerShell commands to use them with SharePoint. This SPC, we've got another one for you. We call it Build Better, Build Quicker, Build Faster. I'm going to go back over here, and we're going to end the session with this. You can visit the Windows PowerShell Resource Center today on TechNet. It's a new HTML5 touch-enabled version of the PowerShell command builder that I put together for you this year. You can use it on tablets. You can use it on a Windows phone. You can use it on iOS, as long as the browser supports HTML5. The other thing that I've done for you is I didn't take away SharePoint Server 2010. Those commandlets are still there. You also have access to SharePoint Server 2013. And lastly, in SharePoint Online, guess what you can do now? You can do remote PowerShell. So you have commandlets related to that. It also supports offline access. So if you've experienced the connectivity over the last couple of days, you know you're going to need offline access. So we use HTML5 app cache. We make that available to you. The last thing I'll say to you before I let you out the door 3 minutes over is please do an evaluation. Let me know how I did. I know we went extremely fast today. Unfortunately, we had a lot of information to cover in a little amount of time. You'll find me wandering around the hotel. Feel free to grab me. You'll find me wandering around the pavilion. You can grab me there. We can talk more in depth. Keep an eye on the blog. The posts are going out today, and they're going to provide deep information on these features. And the last thing I'm going to say is we've got 10,400 people here this year. Enjoy SPC, and we're glad that you love SharePoint as much.